Hello and welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I'm Peter Suderman, filling in for Matt Welch, who is watching a bad movie on an airplane and crying again. Today, I'm joined by my regular co-panelists, Catherine Mengu Ward and Nick Gillespie, as well as special guest, Reason's very own Eric Boehm. Everybody say hello.
Howdy.
Hello.
Hey, happy Juneteenth, everybody.
Happy Juneteenth. Happy Father's Day. Happy Monday, folks. So today we are going to talk about inflation again and what it means for both Joe Biden and Congress. It's timely and relevant, so we are going to call this segment Keeping Up with Currency Events.
No.
Last week we saw the release of the latest monthly data from the Consumer Price Index. That index showed inflation up 4% in the year leading up to May, the slowest rate of price increases in more than 2 years. Inflation was down considerably from the previous month when it rose 4.9%. It was also down from a peak last summer of about 9 to 10% when inflation was rising faster than at any other time during my own lifetime. This cooling follows a series of aggressive interest rate hikes from the Federal Reserve, which has said repeatedly that it intends to clamp down on rapid price hikes by raising interest rates. For the last year, the central bank has attempted to strike a tricky balance, engineering what some have referred to as a soft landing, in which inflation cools, but the U.S. economy does not enter a recession. This has been a historically difficult task. And yet, inflation is down, at least from its peak, and at least for the moment. And we are not currently in a recession as far as we know. Some observers are now suggesting that the Fed has actually achieved, if not the impossible, then the unlikely, a kind of immaculate disinflation in which price hikes level off without serious harm to the rest of the economy. So did the Federal Reserve's interest rate hikes maybe actually kinda sorta work? Before we answer that question, I wanna go to Eric and fill in some backstory here. Eric, you have been covering inflation for Reason since prices started spiking in March of 2021. A lot of your coverage has been granular, focusing on the month-to-month reports, changes in the CPI, the Consumer Price Index. But to start things off here, I just want you to tell us the story of inflation in the United States over the last 2.5 years. Big picture, what happened and why?
Yeah, I think to tell the story of the last 2 years, you actually have to go back a little bit before that. So let's start with since the last financial crisis kind of ebbed, right, in 2011, 2012, we've had annual inflation rates of below 2% just about every year since then. There's only been 2 years where the average rate was above 2%, and the highest of those was 2.4% in 2018. So that's the baseline that we're working with, sort of historically low inflation, but consistent for about a decade or so. We had this very low inflation rate to go along with really historically low interest rates, because the two are kind of connected, as you suggested there, Peter.
Rates that were so low that some people actually described them at times as negative.
In some cases,
like effectively negative, right?
Effectively, yeah. And you had this argument, I think this is somewhat aside, but I mean, you had this argument for a long time that like, oh, the government should actually borrow way more money because it's so cheap to borrow money. And yeah, eventually you see where that leads. But the story of inflation is that starting in, as you said, in March of 2021, really in like the summer of 2021 is where this really ramped up. We hit the 5% annualized rate threshold. We crossed the 5% threshold in May of 2021, and then it kept climbing. 9.1% in June of 2022 is the peak, and it's been coming down sort of haltingly, but steadily, a bit stubbornly maybe since then. We were at 6.4% in January. We're down to 4.0%, as you said, for May. So that's, you know, yes, that's a full, you know, well down, 5% down from where it was at this time last year, but it's also still double kind of the traditional where we had been for the decade before the crisis, the COVID crisis and the sort of existing inflation crisis struck. So that's the trend line that we've seen. And then there's, you know, yeah, there's a number of factors that have contributed to this. And I think you have to go back ultimately to something that, you know, like economists like Larry Summers were warning about, a number of other prominent, you know, economists and financial watchers were warning about in 2021, sorry, which was the passage of that like last major COVID stimulus bill. The one that Biden did after coming in office in January of that year. Yeah, it was the American Rescue Plan,
which was about $2 trillion.
And there were sort of a lot of warnings out there that this is going to overheat the economy, that we've already dumped so much money in over the course of the first really year and a half of the pandemic, that this was going to be too much. And, you know, certainly whether there's a causal link there is something that is still being debated. I think there's quite a bit of evidence that there is some causal link there, but there's certainly a correlation between that bill passed in March and then by the summer we saw this huge run up in inflation. I will just point to one of those sort of connections that has been drawn. It was a study that was released by the St. Louis Federal Reserve last year. Earlier this year, January of this year, where it was a trio of economists there who concluded that, quote, "We find that excess inflation is significantly correlated to domestic stimulus and to various exposures of foreign stimulus," basically pointing to the fact that unlike famous, you know, the line from Uncle Milton, that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. In this case, inflation, while a monetary phenomenon for sure, had a fiscal component to it.
So we spent a lot of money, and when we were planning to spend a lot of money, some people warned that that would cause inflation, and then we had a lot of inflation. It seems like there's a kind of a straightforward story here. So Nick, at the very top of this podcast, I posed what is obviously and intentionally a provocative question for libertarians, which is whether the Fed's program of interest rate hikes has actually worked or at least helped in achieving the goal of reducing inflation here. I just want to ask you that question directly. The Fed hiked interest rates. They said, we're going to do this until inflation slows down because we believe that this is the best way to control inflation. A year or so later, inflation has not dropped down to its 2% target, but it has cooled considerably, and we are not in a recession. What lessons should we take from this? Did the Fed actually kind of maybe do its job as promised?
Well, you know, the short answer is that, you know, the general economic theory is, the macroeconomic theory is that if the Fed hikes interest rates, it takes money out of the economy. I mean, so that it should have a deflationary effect. I don't think it's surprising that that seems to have happened. It also chills, you know, economic activity, because people don't know, is the Fed going to go full early 80s and, you know, continue raising rates up into, you know, well into double digits, you know, reaching near 20%, or so that interest rates in general or mortgage rates are close to 20%. It freezes a lot of future economic activity. The important thing to note is that we're still in process. I mean, the economy is always in process, but the idea that you have a couple of quarters of, you know, good or bad news, that that's the direction that is going to be in place for the next 20 years or something like that, is wrong. The main structural problems in the American economy that affect economic growth, first and foremost, is that the government is not just spending a ton of money, but it's borrowing it in order to spend it. This is all debt-financed expansion of fiscal policy. And the Fed, for most of the past several decades, has had a very loose monetary policy. So who knows what is, you know, what's going to be coming down the pike if and when there's a new president or a new regime and things like that. So, you know, what an economy needs, and this is something Milton Friedman would talk about, but I think also somebody like Larry Summers, what you need is a predictable set of governing policies, including fiscal policy, and you also need a kind of, kind of basic, widely understood, widely shared expectations about monetary policy. And we don't have those. So the fact that, you know, inflation has come down a little bit is great, you know, for people. It also reflects partly an increase in expansion of capacity coming out of COVID and things like that. People are, you know, manufacturers or producers more broadly are able to actually start doing stuff. But we're still not sure what's going on. All we know for certain is that government, you know, and you've talked about this, Peter, you know, federal budgets are going to be above $6 trillion a year, up from like, you know, $4.4 trillion in 2019. All we know is there's going to be a lot more federal spending for as long as the eye can see. We have a bunch of debt-related issues that are coming online. We have massive entitlement problems that are not on the far horizon anymore. Those are icebergs that we can actually see. So there's a lot of reason to be nervous.
I appreciate that you filled in for Matt there, Nick, on the bad metaphors. Like an iceberg that you can see isn't dangerous.
What it's do you mean? Like a big head of lettuce, honestly. Catherine, since...
I don't know about that, but can I also point out that the beauty of the iceberg is that most of it is below the waterline.
Deep.
Yeah.
And that's what there are sunk
only
the
bad
Titanic,
metaphors,
right?
By the way.
Yeah. That's what sunk the Titanic.
Sorry.
Since, I miss Matt.
Since Nick brings up the next president, whoever that person might be, I want to ask you, Catherine, about the political
economic.
I said whoever that person
them.
Might be.
Okay.
I did not gender the person. You're the one bringing gender into
this.
All
right.
This is not just an economic
kind of
story.
Taken gender out of the White House, as did Donald Trump in his own way.
This is not just an economic story, is kind of where I want to go with this. This is a political story. It's a story about vegetables. And I no, wait. Look, elections are often won and lost, at least partially, based on fluctuations in prices, in particular food and gas, both of which have been a big part of the inflation story in the United States over the last 2 years. Right, people care a lot about the cost of living. This was certainly the case in 1980. I mean, you can argue about how big a factor it was, but when Ronald Reagan won the White House, at least one of the stories you can tell is that it was primarily, not exclusively, but primarily because of inflation and the perception that Jimmy Carter couldn't and wouldn't fight inflation. And yet, in 2022, we had huge inflation going into the midterms, right? Like record high inflation. And Republicans, while I wouldn't say they focused on that exclusively, they did talk about it quite a bit. They tried to pin that on Joe Biden. And then you looked at polls and the public was like, well, we don't trust Democrats. We don't trust Joe Biden to handle the economy well and to deal with inflation. But Democrats did not suffer for this in the 2022 midterms. And if anything, they overperformed. So I have two questions for you. Historically, why do you think that was? And what part, if any, do you see the inflation story playing going into the 2024 presidential race? Like, how do we think about this in terms of elections and voter sentiment and what they're going to do when they end up pulling the lever for a president in a year and a half or so?
I mean, I guess I'll start by saying asking me what I think voters will do is like, I have no
asking
crystal ball.
Asking a dog to drive a ship
careful.
Past an iceberg?
Careful there, my friend. So that caveat, you know, I think that one thing is that it's less about the actual inflation number or even about the sort of fundamentals of the economy and much more about people's attitudes toward the economy. And those are two different things. So, for instance, right now, headline inflation is down, but food and energy costs are a huge part of people's perception of inflation, and they're super, super volatile. So I think that, you know, you could see gas prices go up, and it won't matter what the overall trends are. It won't matter what, you know, the Fed is saying or even what's happening with spending. If people sort of wake up 3 days before the election and say, why does it cost $100 to fill up my truck?
Wait, so you're saying that the swing voters who don't pay much attention to the news or politics don't read like CPI reports and look for the super core inflation number?
That is what I am saying. And I know you're shocked to learn this, but I'm here to break this news to you. So I think that there's just this kind of element almost of a dice roll, because the fact is that the sitting president is certainly not contenders for the presidency. They don't have a lot of control over this number, actually. The place where our elected officials can and should be meaningfully make a difference is in spending. But that is a very, very long con, and they are not willing to execute it at this point.
You know, I'd say also, if I may, it, you know, to go to what Catherine's talking about, you know, economic growth is a bigger issue. And that's also something people don't read about that, but you kind of feel it in your bones. Biden made, he talked to a bunch of unions recently, and he was stressing low unemployment rates, particularly for blacks and Hispanics, but overall, and there's like an incredibly low unemployment rate. I don't think anybody in the country is like, oh, you know what, the economy is on fire, and that's why unemployment is so low, you know, and you see that in workforce participation rate, you know, which is not good. Nobody's talking, nobody reads that, but people understand that the economy is sluggish and stagnant. One of the reasons Reagan was able to beat Carter so, you know, easily in 1980 was because people understood things weren't great. They might not have been dire, but they weren't good. You want to change. the reason why Reagan won with, you know, all of the states with the exception of Minnesota, which was, you know, he gave to Walter Mondale, and it was morning again in America, is because the economy between 1980 and 1984 had a major recession and then was really kind of roaring back in a way that everybody kind of felt. And we're certainly nowhere near that right now, and it seems unlikely that we will be by 2024.
Let me add one more wrinkle to the story of inflation, Peter, before we move on from here, and that is that this story over the last 2 years actually has some subparts to it, some chapters to it, right? The first big round of inflation that we saw in 2021 and through early 2022 was driven by food and fuel prices. It was driven by supply chain issues, things like that. Obviously, fiscal stimulus, you know, is just more money in the economy, so more money chasing the same number of goods means that you've got, you know, inflation is going to happen in those situations too. That has really kind of filtered out. And what economists seem to be more concerned about now is the fact that it has moved over and inflation is now primarily moved to services. So it's moved into the service sector in the form of higher wages that create other sort of knock-on effects. It's moved primarily the last few months, it's really been housing. The shelter category of the CPI report is really where most of the inflation is happening now. And like the last few months, it's been up half a percent or more month over month, which is, you know, you can do the math on that. That's 6-7% a year, obviously well outpacing the rate that we're at right now on average. So that's really driving inflation now in a way that it was other things, the more volatile categories that can go up and down more quickly. That's not where we're seeing it anymore. Now we're seeing it in these categories where it will be harder, I think, to bring it down. And so that means this 4% that we're at now may very well become kind of a new normal. And getting back down to 2 will be more difficult. So we're in a sort of different place now than we were 2 years ago or 4 years ago.
Yeah. So, I mean, the housing story is interesting just in the sense that it also plays into another narrative, which is that we've made it much harder to build things over the past several decades. It has become very difficult to build housing in a lot of especially big, already dense urban areas. And so even though they are already dense, it is quite expensive to build. And so in one way, you can argue that inflation is, like everything else, a zoning story. It's kind of strange and hilarious how often zoning ends up being at the root of American political conundrums these days. So Eric, since we brought up spending here, and since, you know, we've talked a little bit about the politics, I want to bring the Congress aspect into here. So there was at the end of last year a big omnibus spending bill that raised spending levels and sort of, you know, this is the kind of thing we've seen before where they basically package all of Congress's budget responsibilities into one big bill at the end of the year. And Republicans, who didn't have control of the House at that point, were kind of mad about it. And so when they did win back the House, they made a point to argue about this and make spending reforms at least theoretically critical to Kevin McCarthy winning the speaker job in the House. And so as all of this has been happening over the past couple of months, we have seen a kind of secondary story, right, happening in Congress where it's not exactly a reaction to inflation, but it's not a reaction to inflation either, right? And so we've had the debt limit deal, where they kind of sort of promised to reduce future planned spending. And then as a result, there were some fiscal conservatives who thought, well, that's not enough. We need a lot more here. And so as a result, there's been a bunch of drama on the House floor, where the right wing faction in the House, the fiscal conservatives, the Freedom Caucus, they have been gumming up the works because they're mad about some spending issues. So tell us just a little bit about what has been happening there and how we should understand that.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is part of a long game that the Freedom Caucus is playing, and you really have to, I think, to understand, well, maybe not really a long game, but you have to go back to the speakership election in January, I think, to understand the state of play in the House and within the House Republican Caucus specifically. And there were a number of things that the House Freedom Caucus got out of that negotiation when they eventually did back McCarthy and allow him to win after whatever it was, 8 or 10 ballots, something like that. And one of the things they wanted, and something that we have still yet to see play out, but something to keep an eye on as we go forward into into the summer and into the beginning of the fall when this will start to happen is the way in which appropriations bills are passed. They wanted changes to this. They want sort of a return to regular order, to like the normal budget process, which is rather than that giant omnibus bill that we pass the week before Christmas every year, or the passage of ongoing continuing resolutions. They want like an actual budget process, which means there are 12 appropriations bills that will all move through their respective committees, that will all come out of the floor. There will be amendments offered. They want all this to happen. And this was all reiterated during the debt ceiling debate when, of course, the demand of House Republicans and in the fiscal right wing, what they wanted was they wanted a rollback of that omnibus bill last year. They didn't get that. McCarthy ultimately backed down in that part of the negotiation. So I think the thing that is sort of there for anybody who cares about the fiscal responsibility and the proper ordering and the proper functioning of Congress is to see whether the appropriations process actually plays out as it's supposed to this year. This will tell us a lot about whether what the House Freedom Caucus has been doing is worth it, whether we can actually reform this budget process. That's not the whole game, right? I mean, like a lot of these, the problems, and I mean, Nick talks about this all the time, and this is very important to point out, is that like the automatic spending, you know, the mandatory spending, Social Security, entitlements, things like that are driving most of our long-term fiscal problems. But if we can begin to at least go back to a normalized budget process, that's at least the first step towards having like actual conversations about how much money is the government spending and where's that spending going. Conversations that you can't have when it's just a single up or down vote at the end of the year on an omnibus bill. So that's the big thing to watch. And I think there's a lot of little things that are happening right now, but they're all kind of, I think, geared towards the right wing, the House Freedom Caucus, the sort of right leaning group in the House, trying to kind of keep their foot on the control of where Congress is going. That's a terrible metaphor, but they're trying to keep their sense of control over the way that budget process will play out when those bills start to come up, which will be, you know, the end of the summer.
Nick, the debt limit deal, the big spending reduction, which is not, I want to use the word reduction because it's not a spending cut. It's a reduction in planned future spending, right? And the big thing in the debt limit deal was that it's designed to hold down non-defense discretionary spending, which represents a fairly modest fraction of the federal budget, while exempting military and veterans and obviously not touching Medicare and Social Security. And if you see what is happening on the House floor and the pre-discussions about this year's budget deals, it seems like Republicans may not even be able to stick to that. Where does that leave us? Should I just like stockpile Bored Apes NFTs and I don't know, rare whiskey, stuff that's obviously going to be valuable in the future and hope to ride out the fiscal apocalypse? Like, if you can't even do that, something like we have complained about that being too small, but it seems like maybe Republicans who have the House won't even be able to agree on how to actually make that happen. Where does that leave us? What do we do?
I'm betting that you have a stash of Beanie Babies somewhere, Peter, and that you may have forgotten where you buried them, but they're out there. So I would start.
They're actually still in box collectible My Little Ponies.
All right. There you go. Yeah. I mean, this is the biggest problem, I think, for, you know, not for political power, but for, you know, the good, if the United States economy and the country is going to do well, these are the types of questions that need to be answered with some, definite contours. Is Congress going to do anything to restrain spending or bring it into rough alignment with, you know, outlays with revenues? Because revenues, you know, actually have been doing pretty well. But I think we all know people like that. I hope none of us is that person who makes more money every year, but spends so much more that you actually end up further in debt. But that's where we are. And that's just ruinous over the long term. And it sometimes it takes the form of inflation. Other times it takes the form of, you know, just a an economy that isn't growing in any appreciable way and whatnot. So I'm very concerned about all of this, because we know that at a certain point, a lot of things are going to have to change. And if we could ease into those changes, it would be a lot better than just kind of constantly coming up against cliffs that we're jumping off of and hoping that most of us survive.
Jumping off of the cliff.
What? Why?
Until you
I wasn't
hitch.
Talking about pushing grandma over the cliff in a supermarket basket or anything like that.
Until Catherine. You hit an iceberg of lead.
Driven by a car that has finally yeah. caught the car that drives the iceberg.
Catherine, save yeah. us, please.
No
I'm just a simple libertarian journalist, as everybody knows here, but it seems to me like part of the problem with things like the debt limit deal is that it mostly specified what could not be cut. And then all the spending reductions were focused on a broad category of spending, but not actual specific programs, right? So the deal didn't actually say we're going to spend less on this office or on this particular thing that the government already spends money on. And you can see why that's appealing to politicians. No one has to have their fingerprints on any specific spending cut, just on the government's going to spend less on stuff that you don't notice maybe, right? And yet at the end of the day, if you want to cut spending, you have to cut spending on something specific. Like something has to get less money or less money than you were planning to give it. So I have two questions for you. One, it's kind of the same question as I gave to Nick. Like, what is the way out of this bad political dynamic? And second, what should we cut spending on?
Yeah, so this is the kind of standard operating procedure at this point, both of the way that the president presents his proposed budget and the way that Congress actually operates, which is they're working really hard to generate this like appearance of specificity and real action items without genuinely doing anything specific or actionable. This is the ideal of politics in 2023. Because you can't just hand wave it, right? Like you can, and we do, but that's what we've been doing for the last decade or so at least, which is this kind of like, oh, we're just going to do cuts across the board and it's all going to work out and it's going to be fine. And then it, in fact, does not work out. But there are no incentives anywhere in here to change this operating procedure until the fiscal apocalypse. And we talked about that, whatever, a couple pods ago, like what exactly is going to precipitate that and when. But until that time, there is no one on the Hill who wants to do this. There was a great quote in the Wall Street Journal this morning or this weekend, I guess, from a former aide to John Boehner and Paul Ryan, who said, it's almost the nature of survival as a Republican speaker. You are forced to make promises that are in conflict with each other in order to just live to fight another day. That mentality alone is wildly destructive. It's not wrong as a description. But of course, no one is forced to do this. A politician could just like hypothetically propose actual cuts and try to, you know, enact them into law. No one seems to be in the mood to do that. You know my answer to what should we cut, which is literally everything. We should cut all the things. But I mean, we could do it anyway. I actually read a proposal recently that I kind of liked, which was just anything that's happened in the last 3 years, like any new spending, any new agency, any new department, any new project, just undo that. Because I think it's very, very hard to look someone in the eye and say, like, in 2020, we lived in anarchic poverty and we can't go back to that time. And when you say cut 10% or whatever, people are like, no, it's so much. But like every living person paying attention to politics can remember 3 years ago and it was fine. I mean,
but this
it wasn't
was the
fine
this was the debt ceiling deal, right? The attempt was let's roll back government spending 1 year. Let's right. just go back to where we were
but
on
I
December 1st of last year.
I think
and they couldn't get that done.
And Democrats in Congress said that it was just absolutely going to murder the poorest 10% of Americans.
Child prostitution, like the whole thing will be the firefighters will be. You know, they'll have to burn books to keep warm. Like, you know, there was a whole
no,
thing.
The Republicans would like that.
Right. I guess
that's like a
but
win-win,
but they want the cuts
right?
there. So, yeah, that aligns. But yes, I still think even though it failed, like that is directionally correct for a reform that could actually happen, even if that won't happen.
You know, I think part of the problem is that this is maybe the ultimate legacy of Trump, where he really did get the Republicans away from any credibility on the issue of restraining spending. Because when they were in power...
That's not just Trump.
What I'm saying, his legacy, though, is that he was the final person who was like, come on, they're joking. They're laughing. They're not going to do that. Under Trump with a Republican Congress, it's not like government spending went down. They, you know, they got to a point where they could have, you know, done something about Obamacare. And they're like, eh, not so much. He rubs the country's face in the fact that the Republican rhetoric of being the, you know, the party of small government is absolute horseshit. We all knew this already, right? And that's what George Bush did. Trump made it inescapable that the government is there to give everybody everything it wants. And that's why you want to elect your guy, because you want to be first in line and things like that. And I think this is where like a massive framework change has to happen. And it's probably going to be a lot of politicians or political figures who don't make it through. They are going to have to be the people who say, no, we are no longer the government. You know, we're no longer governing by just giving everybody everything they want all the time. We are actually going to start with whatever the revenue is. And when we run out of money, we run out of money. And that, I think, will win the day because it has to. But it also means that probably a generation of people who lead that kind of charge to change the way we think about the role and responsibility of government will never be heard from again.
Okay, so speaking of Trump and inescapable, I do want to switch gears real fast and take a little bit of time to talk about the Trump indictment and how it has played out over the last week. In particular, I want to focus on the awkward contortions it has produced within the rest of the Republican presidential field. So I'm going to call this segment, Crisscross Will Make You Trump, Trump, and the second Trump is in parentheses. So in 2016, wow. Donald Trump campaigned extensively on the need for protecting secret government documents and on severely punishing those who had violated federal document retention procedures. Much of this was obviously targeted very specifically at his then rival Hillary Clinton, who had used a private email for government business. Trump's campaign rallies regularly featured chants of lock her up, lock her up. And while the rest of the Republican Party did not exactly endorse the idea of jailing Hillary Clinton, the party as a whole didn't exactly repudiate that either, and often attacked her for having used a private email for government business. After all, document retention was really serious business, and Hillary Clinton had done wrong. So just over a week ago, Donald Trump was indicted on well over 30 counts of mishandling government documents. Trump, of course, is running for president again. He's the front runner for the Republican Party. But there are a bunch of other Republican Party contenders, all of whom now have to comment on what to do about Trump. So for this segment, we're gonna do this real quick, and I just want to go around the table and ask for your reactions to some quotes from people who are running for the GOP presidential nomination. Eric, let's start with you. You wrote a great cover feature on Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who responded to the Trump indictment by saying, as a naval officer, if I would have taken classified documents to my apartment, I would have been court-martialed in a New York minute. Is there a different standard for a Democrat Secretary of State versus a former Republican president? I think there needs to be one standard of justice in this country. Let's enforce it on everybody. Make sure we all know the rules. You can't have one faction of society weaponizing the power of the state against factions that it doesn't like. And that's what you see. How do you respond to that, Eric?
Two responses. I know we're supposed to be quick, but two responses. One, this is a great point. Ron DeSantis, I think, is doing the right thing here. He's making at least the first two-thirds of that is a great point. And I think we have seen Republicans have been sort of unwilling to criticize Trump on this. There is, as you just pointed out at length, Peter, and in the indictment, there's like a few pages where they just sort of spell out all the times in which Donald Trump talked about how important it is to prosecute people who like do these sorts of things with classified documents. And so, yeah, I mean, it's an obvious double standard. It's obviously something that you can attack Trump on, and it's not going to convert any hardcore Trump fans, but I think this is something that will speak to a lot of Republicans and anybody who's maybe, you know, on the fence about Trump or DeSantis. So I think it's smart politically. I think it's obviously just true, you know, as a statement. The other thing that I think you have to say about this quote, though, is that last sentence you read. You can't have one faction of society weaponizing the power of the state against factions that it doesn't like, and that's what you see. But, like, on one hand, this is kind of the thing DeSantis is also promising to do, right? Like, a big implicit and even explicit promise in his campaign so far, what he's building up to do, and what he's claiming to have done basically in Florida is to like have weaponized the state against the woke, whatever, however you might define that, or against the left. And so he's like, on one hand, yes, he's making a very good point in an acute way against Donald Trump. On the other hand, he's also kind of undermining his whole case that he's made for himself as like the guy who's going to go fight for Republicans or something by weaponizing the power of the state. So, yeah, there's a lot of complicating factors here with DeSantis, and I think it speaks to kind of the complicated nature of his campaign.
Catherine, speaking of people undermining the case for themselves, well, here I am. No. I want to ask you about former Vice President Mike Pence, who responded to all of this by saying, "To see a former president of the United States be subject to an indictment by the administration of the current president that he may well be facing again in the future, that sends a terrible message to the wider world." Pence also said that the indictment served to further divide our divided politics. This is like extra division. It's like it's long division, I guess. Right. And he said the charges are serious, but also wished that the Justice Department could have found some other way to handle this. What do you think of that? What does that tell you about Mike Pence?
Those words are politician words. Like all of the words in the order sound like a thing that a normal politician would say, but they are from like a through the looking glass world, right? Like, you know what sends a terrible message to the wider world? January 6th. You know what sends a terrible message to the wider world? Not prosecuting people who have committed crimes. You know what sends a terrible message to the wider world? Just packing up a bunch of random boxes of important documents and taking them to your freaking beach house. Like, those are the terrible messages. Not then following up on the logical consequences of this behavior, I think, is not the problem. And then the second part is like gross too. I mean, if the charges are serious, we don't then, you know, go into a back room and find ways to resolve this, to like work this out. I think it's fascinating that every single person who has commented on this has hit on, gee, it seems like there are a ton of double standards at play. It seems like there's wiggle room in the rules, and then no one can quite get all the way to, so maybe we should have simple, clear laws that are easily enforceable and that make clear to all the participants what the demands are on their behavior. Like, just an idea, but we're not going to do that.
That's a really fascinating idea, Catherine.
We can explore it more in further podcasts. Yeah,
Nick. Instead of asking you about Trump's rivals, I want you to react to a statement from Donald Trump himself. So, at his golf club on Tuesday after his arraignment, because I guess that's what you do—is you get arraigned in the morning and go play golf in the evening, or just go hang out at the
club. Sends a good message.
Said, this was Trump's response. "I will appoint a real special prosecutor to go after the most corrupt president in the history of the United States of America, Joe Biden, and the entire Biden crime family.
Cool.
And then
I will
totally obliterate the deep state," which somehow or another, even though he was just saying this, it's capitalized. Obliterate the deep state. You're in favor of that?
He may well get my vote if he gets the nomination based on that platform plank or promise. Yeah,
the Biden crime family.
I love the Biden crime family. I'm sure that's coming out from Skyhorse Publishing any day now. And I don't think it would be wrong. To me, the big thing among the Republican primary opponents here, forget about the Democrats for the moment. In 1952, when Eisenhower was vying for the Republican nomination against Robert Taft, the senator who was Mr. Conservative, all of that, the way Eisenhower finally, tipped the scale was by saying Taft can't win, which was true. Taft was not popular enough. He did not, he wasn't going to, get 50% of the popular vote. Somebody needs to be saying that about Trump, because Trump has run for president twice. He got 40 in the 46% range of the popular vote. Nobody thinks, on the third time he's going to get 51% of the popular vote or anything like that. They need to start attacking the electability of Donald Trump. And again, it may not work, but, if you are trying to excuse away why Donald Trump, like Hillary Clinton didn't go to jail, so Donald Trump shouldn't go to jail, they did effectively the same thing. I don't think either of them should go to jail, but neither of them should be in, you know, hold office again. But I think you need to see Republicans, you know, actually, you know, kind of get strong and say Trump can't win. We need the next person.
Republicans, get strong. That's the message here. You got to go to the gym. All right, let's pay some bills before we go on. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Do you find yourself getting caught up in what everyone else wants and never taking a moment for yourself? It's a difficult balance for anyone, and it can leave you feeling burned out. That's where therapy can help. Therapy can give you tools to find more balance in your life. You'll be better positioned to help others without leaving yourself behind. Therapy can help you learn coping skills. It can help you set boundaries. It's for everyone, no matter your personal history or state of mind. It can empower you to be the best version of yourself. If you're thinking of starting therapy, why not try BetterHelp? BetterHelp is entirely online. It's flexible and convenient. You can fit it into your schedule. All you have to do is fill out a short questionnaire to be matched with a professional therapist. You can switch therapists anytime. Find more balance with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/roundtable to get 10% off your first month. All right. Next up is our listener question for a segment about presidential pardon powers. I'm going to call this one Pardon Me for Asking. Hello, all. Given the recent indictment of a former chief executive, I think this age-old question is once again very relevant. Was Gerald Ford right to pardon Richard Nixon? Thanks. This question comes from Ben. Catherine, let's go to you first.
So the argument that I've always found the most compelling is the one that Ford himself offered, which was that he said, he reminded folks that there was a Supreme Court decision that held that accepting a pardon is tantamount to admitting guilt. And the thing that was really important to Ford was that Nixon admit guilt. And he initially actually wanted like a statement or something that he pushed for really hard. But in the end, the sort of legalism of the notion that accepting a pardon is admitting guilt was enough for him. I get that. I feel that. Like, I don't, in general, think that incarcerating people is a good way to solve problems. And so, you know, that does extend to presidents. Like, that to me is the best case. I am, again, sympathetic to the notion that that takes us right back to the smoky room I was just complaining about with Pence, the kind of backroom deal where presidents get treated differently. I would be happy for many, many more people, in addition to presidents, to receive pardons if that was on the table. But yeah, I think that's the best case for what Ford did. I don't know how good a case it is.
I don't think it was the right decision at the time. And I think that it did not give the airing to all of the issues that were attendant to it and to the deep distrust that people have in governmental institutions. If we had done a full kind of trial of Richard Nixon, and again, it doesn't have to end with him going to jail or anything like that, but a really full public airing would have gone a long way to lancing, you know, a boil that is, you know, constantly getting reinfected. Sorry, what, Catherine? What do you want to call it? There's a body politic, a metaphor, and it's covered in boils. And one of them is the fact that we did not get a full understanding of what Richard Nixon was up to and why. And the 70s, and, you know, under Ford, I mean, we had the Church Commission, we had the Rockefeller Commission or Committee, et cetera, that looked at a lot of this stuff and about government overreach and about surveillance. You know, we needed more of that. You can't get rid of the past until you actually fully kind of engage it and, you know, lay out what actually happened.
All right, Eric, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think I side more with Nick than Catherine on this. I think it probably would have been good for the country to see the president go on trial. Again, I don't think Nixon should have gone to prison probably for his crimes. I think, like, you know, finding him guilty and just saying, well, you can't run for president again. Not that he was going to, but in this case, that kind of matters, the current situation. I think those sorts of things would be important. And I think it's just that, like, setting that precedent is important, right? The idea that presidents are really no different than people. They're just people. And if they commit crimes, they should be held held accountable for them is sort of the, you know, baseline bedrock of our entire functioning system. So I think it probably would have been in the country's best interest to see that go to trial. And then, you know, that would maybe help give us some guidelines or some, you know, guideposts at least for what to do now that we're in a sort of similar, very different, but in some ways similar situation.
All right. So we've got just enough time for our lightning round segment here. This is about Joe Biden's war on junk fees. And so I'm going to call this segment Joe Biden's Got Junk in His Trunk. Yeah. And look, his war on junk fees appears to have produced maybe kind of an actual victory. This is the opening sentence from a Los Angeles Times piece titled How Biden and Taylor Swift Beat Ticketmaster. Ticketmaster, the country's largest ticket seller, will begin disclosing fees up front after angry Taylor Swift fans demanded changes and the Federal Trade Commission proposed new regulations. Catherine, how much should Taylor Swift fans be thanking Joe Biden and the FTC? And how much should Joe Biden and the FTC be thanking Taylor Swift fans?
I think you know my answer, and that is that, like, any credit that Joe Biden takes for this is stolen valor. Like, this is clearly the work of just outraged Swifties who were probably planning a march on Washington, for all I know, that would have rivaled some of the great marches on our fine city. I just think this is a wonderful, wonderful example of, like, sometimes it takes a minute for markets to sort themselves out, but that every single person in America who has ever bought a ticket for a concert in recent memory has been like, hey, this sucks. This is terrible. And that eventually that kind of accumulates and either the big players change or small players rise up and offer alternatives. I am looking forward to this journey being taken by Airbnb, which has not yet gotten there, but we do not need the president for this. Oh my God, we don't need the president for this. And we really don't need him to have talked about this in the State of the Union. Like, I'm going to be mad about that forever. The State of the Union is for important stuff, not for families should sit together on a Southwest flight, for crying out loud. And all credit to Swifties, no credit to Biden. And anything that Biden did do to further this was, like, crappily unconstitutional.
So what you're saying is we need a moonshot for banning junk fees.
I hate you.
That's it. Space junk. Space junk.
All right.
Fees.
So I think that is that's enough on junk fees here. This is a junk segment, and we're gonna move on to our end of show, what you've been watching. Eric, let's start with you.
I'm going to reach back a little bit because I don't get to be on this podcast too often. So I'll reach back to something I watched in March. I took a little trip over to the United Kingdom and saw the play adaptation of the Neil Gaiman novel Ocean at the End of the Lane. And it blew my mind. This is the coolest thing I have ever seen on stage. It's a story. If you haven't read the novel, you should. There's probably some disagreement among people on this podcast, but I think it's probably Neil Gaiman's best novel. It's that one or American Gods for me. It's a story about a kid who sort of gets caught up in a kind of supernatural situation, and it blurs the lines of, like, where our reality ends and this, like, fantastical realm that might exist, you know, at the woods at the end of your street when you're a kid, that sort of thing. Really is also kind of a love letter to, like, 80s, those sorts of, you know, kids growing up in a fantasy world film, like the Neverending Story type things, or Labyrinth, that sort of story. It's really a love story about being a free-range kid, actually. Thank you, Lenore Skenazy. But that, like, the set design, the lighting, the overall stagecraft were just phenomenal, absolutely stunning. There are giant puppets, like Skeksis from the Dark Crystal style, like giant puppets that people are inside of walking around on stage to play some of the villains in the story. There's also, like, a bunch of really cool little magic tricks. So there's, like, the big, really impressive stuff. There's also, like, little subtle things. There's, like, a tea cup that sort of appears and disappears because of some sleight of hand tricks that the characters do on stage just in the middle of, like, normal scenes, just to sort of give you this sense of, like, magic and wonder in this world. It's one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. It is, there's going to be a revival of it. It was touring around the UK. There's now going to be a revival of it in the West End later this year. I don't think there are any plans at the moment for it to come to the US. I hope if it does, I will gather all my friends and take them. But if you happen to be in the UK, if you happen to be taking a trip to London anytime, look it up, The Ocean at the End of the Lane. At the very least, you can read the novel, which is also just, like, beautiful and full of, you know, heart and emotion, and all of that comes through in the show. So that's really spectacular. 10 out of 10 recommend it.
I really want our listeners to appreciate the magic of Eric Boehm, which is that his psyche is composed of equal parts dark crystal and like budget data. And like that's a beautiful person.
You need to escape from the politics, and my escape is like giant puppets. It is my escape.
I thought it was going.
I am
the
biggest
other way.
Fan of Reason's puppet videos on staff. People who aren't here probably don't know that, but I love these, and go watch these on our YouTube channel, on our Reason TV YouTube channel. They need to get more likes and more attention so that the Bragg brothers make more of them because they are just gorgeous.
We recently moved offices, and like the crates of puppets that came with us. Like, they're all clear plastic boxes, and I can only assume that the Reason TV crew did that on purpose because it's, like, you know, puppets of, like, furry cops squished against the plastic. Beautiful.
No puppet. You're the puppet. Catherine, what have you been consuming?
I did a little bit of celebrating of Juneteenth early, which is to say, you know, I think all holidays should be honored via food. This is like a uncontroversial truth. I listened to two podcasts that are some of them are a couple years old about Juneteenth and food. One is called For Colored Nerds, and the episode is Watermelon and Redbirds. And then there was also an episode of Code Switch called A Taste of Freedom. I recommend them both. The Code Switch podcast has a little kind of digression on whether it will be good or bad or what it will look like as Juneteenth becomes more commercialized. As we just, you know, we've just made our way through Pride weekend here in D.C. with its usual controversies about whether like the, I don't know, whatever it was this year, like the Goldman Sachs Pride float is, you know, victory or defeat.
Oh, I definitely got stuck in Pride Parade traffic, not quite behind, but right within view of the Lockheed Martin.
Yeah,
Pride
there it is.
Float.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think, you know, in all celebrations, like food is part of making it a kind of a special day. And listening to these podcasts definitely inspired me to do a little Juneteenth cooking of my own. So, Four Colored Nerds, Watermelon and Redbirds, and Code Switch, A Taste of Freedom.
What are the Juneteenth foods, Catherine?
So there was a lot of conversation actually in the Watermelon and Redbirds podcast about just like any food appropriately seasoned. And I really feel like this is something that like, you know, Black culture has brought to white culture, among other things, via TikTok, is like, just put some seasoned salt on it. Just put some paprika on that, like a lot. Have you considered garlic powder? Do it. You know, get some flavor in your food. But other than that, some excellent discussion of greens. I'm a big fan of the
The
slow cooked greens. I could be talking about the party. I could be talking about the food. You decide. Slow cooked greens.
Collard greens are fantastic. Like that's, yeah, one of those things that more Americans should know about.
Yeah. But again, got to season them.
Yeah, of course. Got to cook them with some like bacon and some pork.
Yeah. Otherwise, they're just squishy leaves.
My recommendation for this week was definitely underseasoned. I watched The Flash, the long delayed solo outing adventure from the DC Comics superhero who runs real fast thanks to the Speed Force. And I will say the title is dead on. Because if I had not had a professional responsibility to watch this movie all the way through, I would have been out of that theater in a flash. It is yet another superhero multiverse movie, and it's anchored by an incredibly grating performance from Ezra Miller. Really two performances as two different versions of the character, because this movie has a whole Back to the Future thing going on to the point where it even references the way that Eric Stoltz was originally going to play the Michael J. Fox role. Michael Keaton shows up as Batman again, you know, a role he hasn't played since the early 90s, and that's fine. I like Keaton. I even occasionally love Keaton, but it really didn't do much for me because the movie just doesn't have any idea how to use him except to say, hey, remember when Michael Keaton played Batman? You sure liked that, didn't you? So it's just an aggravating and unnecessary movie, even if you are even if you have like a high tolerance for kind of mediocre superhero films. And my advice is that if anyone tries
that
to get you to go see it.
Coming from the horse's mouth. Too.
Yeah. If anyone tries to get you to go see it, make like the Flash and run away as fast as you can. Nick, what have you been consuming? And do you have any events or podcasts to tease for us?
Oh, I have all of that. And I want to point out that Taylor Swift fans are idiots because they think that getting rid of fees means that her ticket prices won't just go up. If you want cheaper Taylor Swift tickets, tell her to have more concerts, you know, and that'll bring the price down.
She's had more concerts than like any performer.
No. And she also did this with Spotify. She like Pearl Jam used to be like this in the name of, you know, being real to their fans. They always make their music more complicated or difficult to experience. She was off Spotify for a long time because she was trying to cut a better deal. Good for her. But let's not get misdirected here. Taylor Swift fans, if you want cheaper tickets, tell her she should have more concerts.
I mean, the Taylor Swift ticket story is really the same.
The Swift army is a zombie army, is what I'm trying to say.
The Taylor Swift ticket price story has a lot in common with the American inflation story, because scarcity drives inflation, yep. Right? And so there's too many Taylor Swift fans with too much money chasing too few goods, or at least in this case,
and actually
being Taylor Swift's concerts.
Yeah. COVID is kind of responsible for both of them, right? Because Taylor Swift had to cancel her last tour because of COVID, which is part of the reason why this tour is
also
even more desired.
She also re-recorded her music in order to get out of a shitty contract. But that helps her, but it makes her fans buy a second set of CDs. So
we did, however, get CDs the anymore. Best Taylor Swift album out of this, which is the collaboration with the guy from The National. Nick, what have you been consuming?
So I am consuming Heretics Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable by Brendan O'Neill of Spiked. I'll also be interviewing him for this week's Reason Interview podcast, which will come out on Wednesday. I blurbed this book, and I will read my blurb. Brendan O'Neill is the reincarnation of Christopher Hitchens, a devil's advocate who is always willing to state his case clearly, convincingly, and courageously. I would say I agree with him maybe 50% of the time. I don't understand a lot of his obsessions, and I often disagree with him, but I love the way that he writes and he thinks, and we need more people like him who are really not going to beat around the bush and just talk about what they believe and why. And also, he will admit when he's wrong, if he thinks he's wrong. So A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable is a really good a collection of new essays by Brendan O'Neill of Spiked.
And upcoming events or podcasts, special projects you want to tease?
Next Monday, June 26th, I'm going to be interviewing Tara Isabella Burton on her book Self-Made, which is about identity from Da Vinci to the Kardashians in New York City. If you go to reason.com/events, we're doing a live taping of the Reason Interview podcast. Tickets are $10. Go to reason.com/events. These are always great evenings, and her book is phenomenal and interesting, and we'll disagree about a bunch of stuff that might be fun to watch, and not simply about who is the essential Kardashian, although that is, you know, something worth fighting about.
I'm much more interested in who the essential Cardassian is, the alien race from the Star Trek series. I think it's the Taylor from Deep Space Nine. Eric, I understand you also have an exciting upcoming project to preview for us. Hopefully it's Star Trek related.
It is unfortunately not Star Trek related. I'm working on a limited run podcast series for Reason, looking at, you might say, frustrating, maybe you might say stupid aspects of U.S. trade policy. So it's going to be a 6-episode series that will start in early August. And we're going to ask some questions that you've probably never thought to ask, but hopefully we'll have some appeal to people listening to us here. Questions like, why does the Jones Act make traffic worse on the East Coast? What caused the baby formula shortage? And kind of at the heart of all these episodes will be the question, why can't we have nice things? That's the title of the podcast. Look for that probably on or about August 1st.
Wow, now I really want to know. So we have one more preview for you, which is that next week we are going to have a very special guest on this show. It's going to be a big, exciting time. I'm not going to say who it is, but it's Kennedy. Kennedy. She's going to be on the show next week, and it's going to be great. So tune in. I will be sitting in the moderator's chair once again. Segment titles, Kennedy. Good show. Thanks so much for listening, and be sure to subscribe, recommend, tell your friends. This has been The Recent Roundtable.